Welcome to the Sanity Interview by the New York Sun. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and every week, along with my co-host, Rebecca Sugar, we speak to the people that you want to hear from.
We're joined today by Mark Gerson. Mark's an entrepreneur who founded GLG Group, 3i members. He's also founded and is chairman of two not-for-profits, United Hatzalah of Israel and African Mission Healthcare. That's a very condensed list of all of your very many involvements. We're just giving the highlights. And Mark's written a new book. It just came out Tuesday. It's called Right. God Was Right, How Modern Social Science Proves the Torah is True. So we want to dive right in. And I want to start with a question about the title itself. God Was Right could be read a bunch of different ways. You could hear it as somebody suggesting that it's not, and this was an answer to it. You could read it as your own personal revelation in studying it yourself.
Interesting.
So why'd you call it this? And why did you think it was important that the Bible sort of work together with social science? And who is that meant to convince?
Right. What a great question. So the first thing one has to ask about the Bible or any book is, what is its genre? And the Bible is not a science book. It's not a history book. It's not a cookbook. It's a guidebook that makes hundreds, maybe thousands of claims about our psychology, our sociology, our culture, our society, and our politics. But really, it's fundamentally a guidebook, even a self-help book. We know that because that's what Moses says is in Deuteronomy 29. He said, this book is written for your benefit. It's a self-help book. And its claims for thousands of years, we've only had faith and experience to assess them. But now in the 21st century, we have a new tool, which is modern social science, because social scientists are asking and have asked the same questions that the Torah asks. They just generally don't know it, but they're the same questions. So now we can assess the Torah's claims about all of these things that govern our lives, from what should we wear in the morning to how many times should we go out with the girl or the boy before we get married to how should we think about diversity. We can assess the biblical claims on all of these things with the benefit of social science and the scientific method. And so what I discovered is that all of the claims in the Bible on its vast array of subjects have now been proven true by modern social science. Hence, God was right.
Maybe it's a bit of a ding against social science. Like, what took them so long? We've had this for thousands of years.
Well, exactly. I mean, exactly. But social science is a very useful discipline which uses the scientific method to address the same questions the biblical author asked. And yeah, the Bible, it was astonishing to me to find that the Bible was absolutely right in the guidance it offers for those of us today in 2025 on such a vast array of subjects, ranging from what we think might be the prosaic, although nothing's really prosaic, to the existential. Everything in our lives, all of our questions, our challenges, our opportunities, it's all addressed in the Bible. And now we know the Bible's right on everything.
So was that your personal revelation that when you started to study the Bible, you said, aha, it actually comports with everything I understand about social science and how I live my life?
Well, the revelation was that Moses says the Bible is for your benefit, it's a self-help book. And the revelation was he was more right than anybody except perhaps him knew, that the Bible covers absolutely everything in our lives today. And now we know with social scientific certitude that it's correct on everything. And therefore, it is the ultimate governing and guiding document for each of our lives.
What struck me about your argument is that really since the days of Darwin or even before, there's been this effort to reconcile science and religion, right? And I remember growing up, you know, we'd in a religious Jewish educational context, we'd read these books sort of, you know, proving that or aiming to prove that modern physics validates the story of Genesis or that somehow
the fossils.
And, right, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering about, do you see your book as an entry into that long and distinguished tradition of thinkers from Thomas Aquinas down through the modern day, trying to kind of reconcile these two things that people see as odds? Or are you coming at it from a different angle and a different sort of polemic?
What a great question. I would say my book reads the Bible as a guidebook. And guidebooks make psychological claims, sociological claims, cultural claims, sometimes political claims. They don't make natural scientific claims. So I look at the Bible as a guidebook that's telling us who we are, who we can be, how do we operate with each other, how do we operate in community and society and politics. But so I don't address natural science. The Bible is not a book of natural science. That being said, Erica and I, my wife and I, we attend, I think, the best conference of the year every year. It's the Waterstone, which is a conservative Christian donor advised fund. It's in Columbus Day every year. And 2 years ago, they had a speaker who was a scientist. And he wasn't talking about the Bible per se, but about the existence of God. And what he said is the next generation of evangelists will be scientists. He said, because the more we understand about science, the more we understand that it must have been facilitated, enabled by an intelligent designer. There's no way that the natural sciences could have happened by chance. So I think the natural sciences prove the existence of God, if anyone needed more proof. And what the Bible is a guidebook for how we should live our lives from the moment we wake up and decide what to wear to how we think about the big issues in our society, our culture, and our politics.
Let me just follow up on that, Mark. So would you say your approach reads the Bible literally or seriously or a little bit of both? Because the Bible does make factual claims. It makes claims that Moses lives 120 years or Methuselah lived 937 years. Or, I mean, how do you read that? I mean, I'm just kind of wondering about your practice of reading the Bible and how you think it makes sense.
Well, I don't think the Bible can be read literally. I think the Bible has to be read contextually. I don't think the Bible wants to be read literally. I mean, when the Bible says circumcise your heart, no one actually said, well, you should open your chest and circumcise your heart.
Thank God. Yeah.
Right. But it means you should open your heart. But like the Bible is a work, as many things, it's a work of great literature. So it's going to say things like circumcise your heart. And no one should read that and say, oh, this is going to be painful. So I think the Bible has to be read contextually and to try to assess, like, what does the author really mean? And he never makes it hard to figure out because it's a guidebook and no self-help book is hard to figure out. Mm-hmm. And this is the best ever.
I think Ari and I were talking before you came in about it's always interesting. We both grew up with, strong Jewish education and a foundation in the Bible. It's always interesting when people sort of dig into it later in life or, discover it a little bit later. And I wonder, as you were learning and you still are learning every day, as I understand the Bible, does anything, well, maybe go back to the beginning and what surprised you the most when you sort of opened this book and started looking into it? What drew you into it? What did you not expect? And are you still learning new things every time you read it now?
Every day. So, and Rebecca, that actually gets to the question. One of the astonishing things about the Bible is the more you study it, the more you read it, the more you learn it with others, the more you realize how much more there is to it that you don't know. Yeah. I study the Bible every day and just really Genesis through Deuteronomy. I just study the Torah every day and I'm blessed to, I teach it to primarily evangelical Christians every Tuesday on through Eagle's Wings. And every time we go through the same text, I discover new, very practical, entirely applicable meanings of the same text. So I was astonished by how the Bible is both endless in its depth, that one can, and I think I will, study it till the day I die and continually learn new things. I think the last thing I learn about the Bible will be on the day that I die. So I'm astonished by its depth. I'm also astonished by its breadth. I mean, did God write the Bible? Well, what man could you assign a book and say, I want you to write a book that is going to be absolutely right on every single thing that's going on in society 3,000 years from now? Then you say, well, what do you want it to cover? Everything from diversity to anti-fragility to clothing to dating to education to grandparenthood and hundreds of other things. Just be sure it covers everything. Be sure you're absolutely right and be sure it's absolutely right today and in 3,000 years. No human being could do that.
I think of the Bible, actually. I never thought of it in terms of a guidebook or a self-help book, but I always understood it to be one of the greatest explorations of human nature that I've ever seen. And maybe the runners-up, we were saying, could be like, Milton or Dostoevsky. What do you think is the extra layer to the Bible that makes it stand out from those other
I was going to ask that exact texts. Same question, right? Let's say you had the complete works of Shakespeare and put it next to it. Now, if I looked into that, surely I could derive rules for living, understanding of personality, understanding of romance, of power, of greed, of, right? The world.
A lot.
Right? So what exactly Rebecca's question, what's the difference that makes a difference in the Bible versus the complete Milton or the complete Shakespeare?
Well, I would say that the Bible covers everything. So you can read Shakespeare and get a lot of wisdom from, it's simply awesome. Okay, Shakespeare is simply awesome. That being said, you're not going to learn how much should I give to charity, where should I give to charity, and what's going to happen to me if I do, which the Bible prescribes and has now been proven right when it says what's going to happen if you give a certain amount. That's just one example out of many. Mm-hmm. So there's, the Jewish tradition says if someone tells you there's wisdom among the nations, believe him. Mm-hmm. So of course there's wisdom in Shakespeare and Dante and Milton and lots of other things. There's immense wisdom. But the Bible is unique in both its comprehensiveness, its absolute correctness, and its depth, its breadth, everything. There's nothing like it that covers absolutely everything and gets it right and covers everything in the most practical way. I mean, the Bible is meant to be a self-help book. So whatever you're thinking about right now, from what should I put on in the morning to, I mean, just starting with that, to everything else, how do I coach my team? Why did the Lakers not do well in the 2021 NBA season? The Bible explains it.
What's the answer to that one?
Well, that was a classic super team. And so we can go to the all right. So there's in Genesis.
I would say this year they just didn't have a center.
Right. This year they didn't have a center. But it was interesting. So why do super teams not work? Right. And so in Genesis, it says God says to Abraham, you will be as numerous as the dust of the earth. But in Deuteronomy, Moses says, you'll be the fewest of people. Okay, so how do you reconcile this? Which are we? Are we huge or are we the fewest of people? The answer is we have to be both because the Bible has to be right in both ways. So how is it right in both? It must say you will have few number of people, but you will have an outside number of accomplishments. So your accomplishments will be like the dust of the earth, but you'll be the fewest of people. Okay, how do you get there? You get there, then look to Abraham. How does Abraham with 318 men beat the five kings? Mm. With synergy. And it's that we know that synergy is a biblical concept because in Leviticus, it says five people will chase 100 and 100 will chase 10,000. In other words, you will get stronger as your group gets larger, which is the opposite of how groups usually work. So this story in Genesis explains how you achieve synergy. You have to be coordinated. You have to be motivated. You have to be prepared. It says they're from the same house. They have the same values. So when Kobe Bryant was interviewed, he said he was jealous about one thing with the San Antonio Spurs. And it wasn't that they had a better point guard than he ever had, which is true. He said it's continuity. Mm. He said, those guys have been playing together forever. And the description of synergy with Abraham and the battle of the four kings against the five kings, it explains why basketball teams today succeed and fail.
I'm interested in this claim of that the Bible is correct or right about everything. And I'm curious in what sense you mean that, right? The traditional Jewish belief, as well as the Christian belief, is that it's like the inerrant word of God, right? That every, you know, the famous phrase, Moses is true and his Torah is true, right? It's absolute truth in every jot and tittle and every letter. Is that the sense when you mean that the Torah is always right? Or like rabbinically, it was understood to be true in the sense of like, right, it's the prescription of all the commandments, right? And so it's a guidebook that way. But is that, are you kind of innovating a sort of modern version of that sort of historic understanding of this as like God's divine word or departing
from
it?
So interesting the way you put it. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't like the pious reading of the Bible. And I don't think it's the secular audience or the liberal audience, not politically, just, you know, classically. I don't think the Bible asks us to. Why does the Bible not ask us for piety? Because the center words of the Bible, the middle words, those which divide the first half from the second half, are inquire insistently. Yeah. So by the way, anyone thinks man wrote the Bible? Imagine putting that at the center. Like, who's going to even do the count right in those days? I think the Bible itself is encouraging us by placing at its center the words inquire. It's saying inquire insistently, which goes against a pious reading of the Bible. It's saying, no, challenge everything. Ask everything. And why do we at the Passover Seder and the Haggadah have questions and sons asking questions? Because when you're confident in your tradition, you welcome questions. You have questions? No, bring them. So I don't like the pious reading. I like the inquire insistently reading. And that's
really interesting. So your position is that there's both divine authorship of the Bible, but you advocate an impious reading, right? Usually it's one or the other. People say, if I'm advocating a sort of updated or liberal reading, that means it was authored by a person.
Interesting,
right?
Point,
or
yeah.
They'll say if I'm letter of the law, that means it was given at Sinai. But you have this.
But you're also
hybrid
saying
approach.
That every word is true. If it's in the Bible, then you're searching for a way for that to make sense because it must be true. You said before, so there is some border around the idea that God wrote it. So therefore, that is the truth.
Well, I wasn't looking for it to be true. I found it to be true. And I was looking to see whether it was true. So I wanted to see, is the Bible's prescription on dating true? Is the Bible's prescription on clothing true? Is the Bible's prescription on diversity, anti-fragility, education, the limits of all these things, is it true? And what I discovered over the 3.5 year process of writing the book is that it absolutely is true. But no, I approached it through the middle words of the Bible, and inquire insistently, and I'm going to inquire insistently. I'm going to ask questions. The Bible, the Torah, the Jewish tradition, they want us to ask questions. So I don't like the pious reading, which is... which is really anti-asking questions, whereas the Bible is saying, you could argue that the pious reading is asking questions. Mm-hmm. So how do we know that? Because of Inquirer in Sicily, the middle of the Bible, and because the most important religious event in the Jewish calendar is without a doubt the Pesach Seder. And the Pesach Seder is all about asking questions and even the children asking questions. Mm. So I would say asking questions is the true piety. Kind of the untrue piety is kind of just proclaiming this is true and discouraging questions, where I think true piety is welcoming questions, even skeptical and challenging questions, because the Bible is very confident in itself. It's going to be proven right. And I said it has been. But no, I'm all about if anyone has a question about the Bible, ask it. Challenge it. The Bible wants your questions. It wants your challenges, and give it to them.
So I want to talk about some of the themes that you raise in the book. Yeah. And a lot of social science today, it seems to me, in our culture, is talking about things like happiness, and, you know, major courses in the top universities, most popular ones are always about that.
Yeah.
And other sort of obvious themes. There were a lot of themes that you brought up that I thought were a little less obvious, but really deep and meaningful. Words like humility, words like dignity. These aren't often talked about in our culture, but they're really major themes in the Bible. So could you give us, let's say, an example of what dignity means in the Bible and how social science backs up your claims about what the Torah is teaching us about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are three kinds of cultures in both the Bible and what modern social scientists have discovered. One kind of culture is the victim culture, and the Bible hates the victim culture. How do we know that? Because the Bible says, it instructs us to remember that we were strangers in the land of Egypt, to which any of the three of us might say, hey, wait, God, we were slaves in the land of Egypt. And God would say, yeah, I know what you were, but I want you to think of yourselves as strangers so you don't think of yourselves as victims and you're able to have compassion towards the strangers. In other words, this is another chapter in the book. Let's reframe the story. So, and also the Bible instructs us that you shall not favor the poor nor the rich. Now, who in ancient times favored the poor? Nobody. Mm-hmm. But what the Bible is saying,
modern society favors the rich. Right.
Well, it's the rich or the poor. The Bible is
that
saying
is really an extraordinary commandment. Yeah. I've thought that before. That the idea that both are corrupting,
exactly,
right? in either direction.
In one verse, both are corrupting, because what the Bible is saying is you shouldn't, of course, privilege the rich, but nor the poor. Judge a victim gets no credence because he's a victim. Judge every person by their character, every case by its merits. This is what justice and fairness demand. So the Bible hates the victim culture. It also hates the honor culture. So what's the honor culture? The honor culture says, if you insult me, particularly if you insult my woman or my politics, we're going to fight. Okay, so the pre-war American South was a classic honor culture. Most ancient societies were honor
ancient
cultures.
Ancient world, yeah.
Yeah, the ancient world was honor cultures. But what happens when Lot insults Abraham? If this were the Godfather, what would Abraham do? He would have offed his nephew, right? But it's not the Godfather.
Or had someone else do it.
Or had someone else do it, right. But it's not the Godfather, and it's the Bible. And so what Abraham says is, Abraham is so mission-focused. So he says, if I get distracted and fight Lot, or when Miriam and Aaron insult Moses, what does Moses do? He prays for them, right? So what does a person of dignity do when they're offended or they're insulted? They keep their focus on their mission. So Abraham says about Lot, I'm not gonna harm him. Quite the opposite, exactly. He says separate. Yeah. Sometimes you have to separate. He says, I'm gonna separate, but there's no Abraham and Moses, they both have to fight at various times, but a person of dignity stays focused on his mission, always knows his purpose, and uses violence infrequently and judiciously. Whereas in an honor culture, people are fighting all the time. So by the way, the honor cultures are not dead. I mean, that's the 2022 Academy Awards. Yeah. Right. So
how about the protests at universities today? You could sort of put into that category, too, I would say.
Well,
that's exactly slow to anger. Right.
That's exactly it. So and I think that's one of the most important ideas in the Bible is slow to anger. So when God defines himself as slow to anger, what the honor culture and the victim culture have in common is a quickness to anger. In an honor culture, you get angry and you fight. In a victim culture, you get angry and you complain. Right. Mm-hmm. But in a dignity culture, you're slow to anger. Not never anger, but you're slow to anger. Why are you slow to anger? Because in a dignified culture, if someone insults you, what you say is, am I going to let this distract me from my mission? And you say, you know what? I'm a dignified person. I'm a person of agency. I'm not going to let my life or my actions be defined by someone who insulted me. So in a victim culture, they complain. In an honor culture, they fight. But in a dignity culture, they make decisions about, how can I best pursue my purpose? How can I best execute my mission? And that's Abraham, that's Moses, which is really not what ancient culture was about, honor cultures. And so the 2022 Academy Awards, it's very interesting. half of Americans, and I have a survey in the book that showed this, half of Americans said that Will Smith was right to hit Chris Rock. Mm-hmm. And the reasons why are classic honor culture moves. Well, Chris Rock insulted his woman. Of course, he should hit him, right? Whereas it's just a question of, mm-hmm. am I in an honor culture or not in an honor culture? But the honor culture is die hard. But God loves a dignity culture. The Bible loves a dignity culture, not an honor or victim culture.
We started off talking about genre, and I'm curious, as you were reading through the Bible, do you think that more or less or different kinds of truths are encoded in different kinds of texts? What I mean is sort of how do you read the sort of straightforward commandments? So, for example, about do not favor the rich or the poor,
right?
That's just a commandment versus the more narrative parts where you have to kind of read or the Lot situation.
Yeah.
Is that a different kind of truth, a different sort of teaching, or are they kind of just two sides of the same coin?
Great question. I would think it's more integrated. I think it's two. I think we learn truths from the laws. And by the way, sometimes like when you say, I think your example is perfect, because let's take the one about you shall not favor the poor nor the rich. So you can just read on one level and say, okay, I shouldn't favor the poor or the rich. That's one level. Then you go one level further and you're like, well, this is against the victim culture, mm-hmm. right? And so you see a deeper truth revealed in what seems to be a really simple law, but it's not just a simple law, because it's really saying don't enter a victim culture. Why? Because you could read that and say, well, why would I favor the poor? Well, I'm compassionate towards them, but it just said don't favor the poor. In other words, what it's saying is judge everybody and everything by its merit and its character. So I think we derive great life lessons and very practical guidance from the canonical story of clothing, I think, is Rebecca, when Rebecca has to trick her husband Isaac into thinking that Jacob is really Esau, how does she do it? She tells Jacob, put on Esau's best clothes. Why does it matter what Jacob is wearing? Isaac is blind, okay? Mm-hmm. And so why his best clothes? Because Rebecca understood that if Jacob puts on Esau's clothes, Jacob will feel like Esau and thus be able to imitate Esau much more effectively. Rebecca is the first of what we call now fashion psychologist, mm-hmm. where Rebecca knew that we feel like what we wear and we act like how we feel.
And then Jacob, of course, gives his son the ketonet pasim, the code of catastrophic mistake.
Yeah. Catastrophic mistake, yeah.
One of the most countercultural themes that you conquer in this book is that of getting married young and how to choose a spouse. Everything that you say is the exact opposite of the way Western societies deal with this issue. So can you just talk us through what the Bible has to say about that and why social science is coming around to that point of view?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And this is so important, particularly for young people, but also those of us who are older and counsel young people. So the happiest marriage in the Bible is Isaac and Rebecca, which leads the reader to ask, well, how do they pick each other? And the Bible comes and says, it's really simple. Abraham sends his servant Eliezer on a mission to find a wife for Isaac.
They didn't really pick each other.
Well, okay, but here's how they did. Then we can see, did they pick each other or not?
It was consensual, but they didn't, but not by design, maybe initially.
It was what sociologists call arranged marriage without coercion.
Yeah.
But arranged marriage without coercion, which is, I think, the way we should do it. All right, and so, but how, what does it mean? Well, the biblical story explains what it means. So Abraham tells Eliezer, go find a wife for Isaac. He says, go to Haran. Why Haran? Because previously Abraham had made souls in Haran. So he says, go find a woman in a good place. So he goes to Haran.
So that's important. That's principle number one.
Principle number one.
Right? Go looking in the right place.
Looking in the right
place. There are wrong places.
That's right. Look in the right place. Exactly. And what might that be? Everyone just think. What's a good place to look for a wife or husband? So look in a good place. And then he goes to that good place and he meets a woman. He notices two things about her. Just two things. One, she's very fair to look upon. And two, she's ridiculously generous. She brings water for him and all of his camels. An estimated 25 trips. On the basis of those three characteristics and only three, she's from a good place, she's ridiculously generous, and she's attractive. He says, you're the woman for my man, Isaac. Three characteristics, young people, three characteristics. Then Rebecca is given the choice, well, should I marry the guy? People who say the Bible is sexist do not know what they're talking about. This is one of many examples. Rebecca is given the choice. Her father gives advice, but the ultimate choice, the Bible is clear, is hers. So she only knows two things about Isaac, who she's not met. One, she knows he's rich, so he's a good provider. And two, she knows he loves God. So on the basis of these two and only two characteristics, she decides to marry him. So
women always need fewer cues in life for everything. I'm just saying.
Well, no, that's exactly right. And I said those who disagree with the Isaac and Rebecca model, they're suffering from what sociologists call information overload, which is what we know from finance, and I would argue from dating, is that too much information yields a suboptimal decision. You want to have the right amount of information. So what is the right amount of information? Two or three qualities. Just be sure they're the right qualities. Whether his friends are funny is not one of them, right? Just think of what are the right two or three qualities that optimize for a spouse. And then and they say, okay, so they decide to get married. Do they love each other? People might ask. It's like, let's go to Genesis 24:67, where the text tells us, and the order of things is so important here as often in the Bible. It says, he married her, Isaac and Rebecca. He married her, she became his wife, and he loved her. That's the order. So what does the Bible tell us? Identify two or three characteristics in the other person. Then don't think too much about it. Just get married. Then become a spouse. What does that mean? Probably iterative acts of giving, doing spouse-like things. And then love will follow and continually deepen. And so what does that exclude? There's no notion of falling in love. Falling in love is the most ridiculous concept ever. You don't fall in love. You cultivate love. You might fall in the pool. You might fall on your face. But nobody has ever fallen in love. Love is something we cultivate. Love is something that is developed through action. And yes, feelings emanate from that. But fundamentally, love is something that's cultivated, not fallen into. So in modern society, with the exception of some subcultures. So interestingly, I go into India. Almost all Indian marriages are still arranged, which is interesting because the country of India has adopted many Western customs, Western clothing, Western medicine, Western education.
But largely without coercion, at least among my
always without coercion. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Which is really interesting.
And that's exactly right. So the biblical model is no coercion. Rebecca's saying, do you want to marry him? It's arranged marriage without coercion. So what might arranged marriage without coercion be? It might be saying to your son or daughter, I would like you to meet this young woman whose parents I know or who I met at the workplace, whatever. She's terrific. I really think she has the two or three qualities that you should be looking for in a wife. If you don't want to marry her, it's totally fine. But just date with intention. Take her seriously. You don't need to date for what eHarmony says is the average of 2.6 years before people decide. If you're dating for 2.6 years, you're looking for characteristics that are completely irrelevant. You know, in about, you don't even need 2.6 months. Forget 2.6 years. And I think, and the Bible, Rebecca, to your earlier point, the Bible has been proven exactly right, is that people who practice, and I say so-called, because it's not really, so-called love marriages, people who date for 2.6 years and spend another year engaged, and then, by the way, that's after breakup, and what we've seen is that the feeling of being rejected in a breakup and otherwise presents to the body like physical pain.
That was one of the more interesting things I didn't know and read in your book.
Yeah, it's just no one. It's just people don't think about what are the psychological consequences of just dating rejection. The body experiences rejection very painfully, and
no argument there. But yeah,
yeah, and yeah. So in love marriages, if you add the divorce rate to the rate of endless separation, which is the concept where 20% of couples who've been separated for 10 years are not divorced. Why would that be? Makes total rational sense. She needs his health insurance. He wants Social Security. They don't hate each other or want to get remarried. So why get divorced? Warren Buffett did this. So if you add the endless separation to the divorces and the 7% who are married but chronically unhappy, you get to an unhappiness rate of around 70%.
Yeah. I'm curious about how you read. I feel like I just keep asking you how you read it because I think with the Bible, it's so much of the action is in that. So it seems to me a truism that the Bible's heroes are flawed.
Yes.
Right? So
absolutely.
Your argument is that an individual character could be flawed, but that the book, the Bible as a whole is right. Right? So how does that work? Are the flaws or when a character screws up, is that a moment to learn from? Is that an instructive example? How does that work kind of dynamically?
That's such a beautiful point, AR. I mean, I had not thought of that, but you're absolutely right. I would argue that the fact that all of the characters in the Torah are flawed contributes to its truth because everyone has flaws and things to work on. And the Bible encourages a growth mindset. So, I mean, let's look at Korach's rebellion, which is the great rebellion of the Bible. It's really the first populist rebellion. Korach has a rebellion. He has no positive agenda. What does he say? All the people are holy. In that is the heresy. It should be all the people are striving to be holy. But the heretic says all the people are holy. So no, they're striving to be. They're not holy. We're never there. Moses never gets to the promised land. We're never going to get to our personal promised land. We're going to keep trying and keep working. And no, but the fact that all the characters are flawed allows us to really identify with them and to learn from them and to see how sometimes they conquer their flaws, sometimes they don't conquer their flaws. What are the consequences of their flaws? The fact that every single character in the Bible, even Abraham, even Moses, even Rebecca, arguably the three greats, Certainly Joseph, Judah, I mean, Jacob, I mean, all these greats, they all have flaws which are easily identifiable, which makes them more relatable and easier to learn from.
Do you, I'm just curious, do you read the Bible in Hebrew or English translation?
No, unfortunately, I don't read Hebrew.
Yeah.
I wish I did, but I don't.
That's your next job, because I feel like it would add an even larger layer to it for you. I wanted to ask you about words and speech. You know, the entire universe, the Bible says, was created by speech. And
right.
We talk on this podcast all the time about speech and the erosion of free speech. And what would the Bible tell us about free speech, how to guard it, and its importance?
Well, so you're absolutely right. So so how does God create the world? Through nine "and God saids," mm-hmm. right? Why didn't God snap his finger? Just think about it, right? Because it's what God is saying: if I create the world with words, so too do you create your worlds with words. So worlds are created with words. And then God was right. I go through several ways which this happens. One of which is a section on gossip, which is totally prohibited in the Torah. It talks about gossip as traveling, because once you gossip, like,
it has legs.
Yeah, there's no way to stop it, yeah. Right? Because, you know,
I think in the rabbinic tradition, mm-hmm. you don't gossip in a positive way. You don't say even positive things, because it might lead someone to then say, no, really, there's this negative thing.
Oh, exactly. So yeah, people careful. Say, can I gossip positively? And you're totally right, Rebecca. So in the example I gave in the book was, if I said, Daniel is the best tennis player I've ever seen. Okay, so now you think that's positive. Then you're like, really? Like, I saw a kid who I think is better. Now we're negative,
yeah.
Right? So gossip automatically goes to the negative, even when it starts positive. Yeah. So we're supposed to talk about ideas and not people. That being said, the Torah is very practical, and it's meant to be lived in the world. So there is an exception, which is that in gossip, because while there's a prohibition on gossip, it also says you shall not stand by the blood of your neighbor. Mm-hmm. So if you know that AR is going to go into business with someone he shouldn't, you have an obligation to tell him in as restrained a way as possible, but a full way, here's what I know about this person, here's why I'm counseling you, you shouldn't go into business, because you'd be standing by the blood of your neighbor if you withheld that information. Mm-hmm. So the Bible's very sophisticated.
I've always found that episode of Miriam speaking about her brother and being exiled, and the whole camp waiting in the desert for her, and then, you know, her being Moses praying for her healing. Just
That's my favorite.
Poignant.
One of my favorite lines in the Bible is his prayer for her. Yeah. So short,
please God,
and
heal
so
her
heartfelt.
Now.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
And I think meaningful in terms of teaching us about,
please God, heal her.
Brevity of speech,
and too. Siblings.
Yeah, exactly.
So what does the social science say to back up what you're saying about the Torah's view on speech?
So the social science of gossip is very interesting, which is that we like gossip, right? Yeah. And why do we like gossip? Because it's evolutionarily adaptive, right? So why is it evolutionarily adaptive? Because it enables us to expand out of small groups, because it enables a formulation of reputation. So we naturally enjoy it. But the Bible is often the conquest of what is right over what is natural. So it turns out that all of the evolutionary benefits of gossip can be achieved in the biblical formula. In other words, don't gossip about somebody, except if by not doing so, you're standing by the blood of your neighbor. So yes, a society needs to be able to say, I wouldn't do business with this person. Right. I wouldn't date that person. Lots of other things like that. But the Bible says, of course, don't gossip, but use this exception.
And argues that you can create community in other ways, right? But besides, you know, talking about people.
Right. But the Bible's, exactly. But words are important. Words do create worlds. And the modern social science has certainly confirmed that. But gossip in particular.
Mark, I want to ask you, this feels like a moment, right, in Western culture, in particular in America, very specifically, where two things are happening at the same time, two conflicting things. On the one hand, secularism is sort of at its peak, and there's a rejection of all things religious, biblical. You know, some people attach themselves to spirituality, but largely that whole category of things is sort of rejected on the one hand. On the other hand, Bible sales were up last year more than they've ever been. And people are seeking meaning and purpose. So where does your book fit in? Does it sort of sit in the center of those two movements and bring them together? Does it speak to one or the other more?
What a great question. I mean, I think we can refer to that great ad that I think ran in the 60s and 70s. You don't have to be Jewish to enjoy Levy's famous rye, right? You don't have to be Jewish or Christian or a believer to love and learn from the Bible, because the Bible is a guidebook for all people. So when people say, I need to be religious to learn from the Bible, it's like, no, you don't. Like, the Bible is there for everybody. Now, you might become more convinced of or attracted to your faith, Christian faith, Jewish faith, whatever it is, through the Bible. But anyone who buys a self-help book of any kind, regardless of what religion or political or social or cultural orientation they are, they should just read the Bible. It's the best ever self-help book. Mm. Like, everything in other self-help books is just a small and diminished part of what the Bible says about that very subject.
Yeah. And they should buy your book, God Was Right. Mark Gerson, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, what a great conversation. Thank you.